Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with advocate for hospital safety and transparency and author David Goldhill about his book, Catastrophic Care.
Those two words, I'm not even sure they go together, but because we're not talking about just long-term care insurance, we're talking about a feeling he has about problems with the healthcare system. He is an important author. I look forward to having this conversation with him.
But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about pregnancy and knowing your blood clot risk.
We're going to talk about tonsillectomy. Should you have one?
And we'll talk about caffeine to prevent car crashes.
And then for anyone who's got toddlers, should you be aware or is there a problem with how much salt they have in their diet? Let's talk about our very first research that matters then, Christy.
So this is about blood clots or venous thromboembolisms, the fancy word for a deep clot in your vein that can be dangerous for women who are about to have a baby and can be life-threatening if it moves from the vein in your leg up to the lungs.
Yeah, I did not realize it was this frequent. One out of two pregnancies, women will have these blood clots.
Or one or two pregnancies out of a thousand.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One or two out of a thousand will have these. And, you know, the question is, can you prevent them? And I think traditionally, if you'd asked me, you know, what are the risk factors, I would have said, well, certainly smoking and maybe if you are immobile, if you don't move around very much. But this was actually some interesting research.
Well, there's a lot of attention that has been drawn to risk factors related to this about age and body mass index or how overweight a person is, smoking, high blood pressure, etc. But this study really looked to over time of people between the ages of 15 and 44 to see once you control for things, what are the real risk factors that are most important for us to let people know about?
Yes, they followed close to 400,000 pregnant women. That's a large study by any measure there. And what they discovered is that having that body mass index over 25, being overweight or obese, and being older than age 35 raised the risk of these clots during a pregnancy. And particularly if your BMI, your body mass index is over 30, which you really are obese, four times as likely. These are important things because it suggests that we really need to work on behavior modification strategies in addition to quitting smoking.
They found some other associations with pre-existing diabetes, previous births, bleeding during pregnancy, some other things. But the two big things, the most significant risk factors were women with a body mass index over 30, so obese,
yep.
And if a woman has a stillbirth.
Yep. So and you know where this research was published, Christy?
Where was it published?
The journal Blood. It seems like an appropriate name of a journal. You don't know what you know exactly what that journal is about. Speaking of knowing exactly what an article is about, this next research that matters is about tonsillectomy. And this is really interesting because I was just talking with a neighbor the other day, Christy, and they were wondering whether or not their child should have a tonsillectomy.
Well, most frequently in our country, we think about tonsillectomies in the setting of children with frequent strep throat infections. But this was a study in Finland looking to see if doing this for people who have severe sore throats, maybe not just from strep, but who get sore throats a lot, could reduce their frequency of getting this problem.
And this journal, this article published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal involved 86 patients, about half who got a tonsillectomy and half who didn't. And then they followed them 5 to 6 months out to see the rates of complications as well as the potential benefits of the surgery.
And what they found at 5 months was that only 3% of the control patients, and none of the tonsillectomy group had a severe sore throat. And
that's good.
Yeah, that's good. And they found that with mild sore throats, it was a little bit more significant. And the people who had their tonsils out noticed an improvement in their quality of life. They lost less school or work days related to their sore throats and felt like it was a good thing.
On the other hand, you can't really do a randomized blinded trial. You know, if you get your tonsils out, and perhaps you're more likely to report some benefit here. I think, you know what? I'm not going to advocate for people to get their tonsils out just to reduce a sore throat. But if you have recurrent strep throat, I think it is a consideration.
I completely agree, Adam Goldstein. Let's do our next one about caffeine.
This is our favorite topic, Christy.
I know. We always talk
about
coffee.
We both love coffee, and we have reason number 403A why we both love coffee. This was a research that was in the British Medical Journal about caffeine and car crashes.
And they looked at drivers who drive heavy, heavy trucks for long periods of time and to see if there was a difference of people who drank caffeinated drinks regularly during their driving compared with people who didn't.
Right. About 500 who had had a crash and 500 who had not had a crash. And then they controlled for all kinds of things like the age, how often they took breaks, what their sleeping patterns were. And they found out those who drank caffeinated drinks, one of those monster drinks with tons of caffeine, or took caffeine pills to stay alert, which I've never done, but they were two-thirds less likely to have a crash than the drivers who did not take those pills or have that caffeine.
I mean, and the difference in crashes, I mean, 63% less likely to crash. That, to me, is significant.
Yeah, they had a little less sleep, which is a little worse because they're out on their driving, but at least they're not crashing while they're up driving those trucks. And it does suggest, again, that, you know, perhaps there's some benefits here, certainly not a drawback. They did find some other associations with crashes relating to those who were heavy smokers, and I could really understand this. If you're down there, you know, with a lit 3,000-degree cigarette, tapping it, I could see some crashes here. But the caffeine, very interesting.
Very interesting. Our last research that matters is about salt in toddler snacks. And it's kind of no surprise to look at this, to think about how much salt we as a nation put into those prepackaged snacks and meals for our toddlers.
Yeah, I was in Whole Foods, which you would think is a wholesome place, recently with my daughter, Christy. And we were looking at some of these incredibly wholesome soups. These were not for toddlers, but adults. And I had looked at them previously, and I said, you know, you think this is incredibly healthy, but look how much salt is in the serving that you're going to get. And it was close to 1,000 milligrams
Wow.
in these wholesome organic soups. So it's not just organic here. This study looks at this for toddlers.
And they categorized baby food for toddlers as food that was intended for children between the ages of 1 and 3 and defined it as high in sodium if it had more than 210 milligrams of sodium per serving. And what they found was that it ranged as high. Some of these little servings had 630 milligrams per serving, which is 40% of the recommendation for the day.
Right, 1,500 milligrams or 1.5 grams is the recommended daily limit. And they were looking here at over 1,000 products for babies and toddlers. And I think the bottom line here is you can't assume that a product that is either organic or non-organic is actually going to have low sodium. You're going to have to probably look for it. And maybe as consumers, we got to demand it.
Well, and I'm not worried that that salt is going to drive that toddler's blood pressure so high to cause a problem. But we are teaching our infants and toddlers to want the taste, desire the taste, appreciate the taste of these high salt foods, which then impacts their whole life.
Right. They're not going to eat those carrots, are they?
Exactly.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Christy. We've had a nice chance not only to talk about salt and toddler snacks,
but also to talk about getting your tonsils out for sore throats.
If you're driving these commercial trucks, caffeine could prevent some decreased crashes.
And if you're thinking of becoming pregnant, to talk to your doctor about ways to reduce your blood clot risk.
Particularly losing weight if you're overweight before pregnancy. That'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with our guest, David Goldhill, about his book, Catastrophic Care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with David Galdhill, advocate for hospital safety and transparency and best-selling author, about his new book, Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. Welcome to Your Health, David.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for being with us. David, we would love to launch in with how this became something that you are on fire about.
Well, my interest in healthcare really starts with a personal tragedy, the loss of my dad, who walked into a hospital for observation and somehow in the next couple of days acquired the first of a series of infections that killed him 5 weeks later. You know, that's obviously a very difficult experience, but what I was, I guess, surprised by and what got me started in thinking about healthcare was finding out a couple months after my dad's death that it was a remarkably common experience, that somewhere around 100,000 Americans are estimated to die of hospital infections a year, some number between 50 and 100,000 from other types of medical errors, and that most of these infections are regarded as preventable. In fact, relatively easily preventable. And so, in addition to the grief I felt, you know, for this terrible personal loss, as a businessman, I thought to myself, well, how is it possible that something so easily preventable can occur so many times, so often, and not be a very big issue in our lives, which, let's face it, is a fairly hidden issue, I think, amongst the many healthcare problems. And that's what got me thinking about healthcare. Why is it that we give it a pass, that we sort of assume that not just about safety, but about quality and all elements of customer service, all the way up to the price of care? Do we as consumers and as citizens just accept that healthcare is and has to be different? And that really is the foundation of most of the writing I've done since.
Well, you know, I have to give you a kudos here for really diving into something. I think our viewers might assume that you have a background in health or, you know, have a master's in health policy, but indeed you have experience because you're president and CEO of the Game Show Network. You have a major responsibility for helping provide healthcare, but here you are diving in to learn about it yourself from the aspect of a consumer advocate, and that I think is incredibly unique.
Well, thanks. I think, you know, the book really is intended to be from really two perspectives. One is a patient and a father and a son of people who use the healthcare system, obviously. And the second is as a business person who's been in a variety of other businesses, including now running the Game Show Network. And so I have to be concerned about employees' healthcare. It's a bigger and bigger issue every year, but also I see how other businesses function and how other businesses are held accountable. And so part of it is being what all of us are, is a patient and consumer, and the other is just insisting that maybe some of the things we know about how other industries operate actually are relevant to how healthcare isn't operating.
You talk a bit about just a difference that society would be shocked about preventable deaths in another capacity, but doesn't seem to respond or be as incredulous about what goes on in the healthcare system. And jumping in, you launch up pretty early on in your book about questions about the money, about how society can afford healthcare for anyone, but yet even the people in the top 1% don't have the resources to cover their care, and that we're not as a society really thinking about where that money comes from. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah. So, Christy, as you point out, a very early part of the book looks at an entry-level employee in my company Becky, and she's 23, and she's just starting out. She's on an entry-level salary. And it really asks her, you know, what she thinks she's putting into the healthcare system. She has absolutely no idea. And so I do the math for her. If Becky has sort of a nice career, but doesn't get particularly rich, has a nice middle-class income, grows 3% a year till she retires, has a family, she's going to put in, assuming healthcare costs grow by 0% from now till the end of her life, you know, a statement that isn't true even in the time it took me to make it, she's going to put in well over $1 million in her healthcare system. When you look at cost of insurance premiums, her taxes to pay for Medicare, her taxes that will go subsidize Medicare or pay for Medicaid, and all the other elements, her out-of-pocket, her deductibles, when you add it all up, she's going to put in well over $1 million. I actually get to $1.2 million. If the Affordable Care Act works as expected, in other words, controls the cost of growth, she's actually going to put in $1.9 million. Remember, I said that was at zero growth. No one expects zero growth. Here's what's interesting about that, is that that's far more than not just the average, but almost anyone will actually spend on their family's health care over their lifetime, even at the inflated prices we have. And so one of the things that and it's the reason it starts the book, that I think we need to understand is it really is impossible to build a system in which nobody is funding their own health care. Everybody is being paid by somewhere else. At the end of the day, almost all of us are paying a tremendous amount of money into the system and are getting back a lot less because the system's very expensive to run. It's administratively complicated, lots of distortion, lots of waste, lots of excess. And so it's a bad deal. But it's a bad deal that most of us think we're getting a good deal for. Wow, isn't it great? I couldn't possibly handle it without insurance. I'll give you a little example of that. My general counsel came to me and said that a friend of his kidneyed an appendectomy. Total price of the appendectomy, and we all know prices mean nothing, but total price of the appendectomy is $12,000. What family could possibly have $12,000 lying around to pay for something like that if it wasn't for insurance? Well, I pointed out that the average cost of an insurance policy for a family in that state is more than $20,000 a year. So if you had the premium instead of the insurance, your family would run out of appendices well before it ran out of money.
You know, we're talking with David Galdhill, the author of a really new important book called Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. And David, do you think that part of this problem is because of the fact we are we're so absorbed in our day-to-day routines, and we just assume that, well, this is the cost of doing business as an individual, however imperfect and more imperfect it becomes, or is the complexities of this whole issue overwhelming to us, so we just say we can't deal with it? Where do we fit?
So I think it's yes to both. I think healthcare systems here and around the world developed at a time when most healthcare was urgent and essential and fundamentally rare. And in the 50 years in this country, 60, 70 years in other countries, since we started essentially subsidizing all care, either directly or through taxes or what have you, what's happened is the healthcare system has grown to be integrated fully into our lives. Everybody uses doctors constantly. Much of healthcare now is not really about directly saving lives. It's about managing conditions over long terms that could affect your life or could affect your vitality. A lot of healthcare is about making your life better or more vibrant. You know, a lot of the growth in healthcare has been in things like knee replacements and hip replacements. It's not these things aren't good, but it's a very different model than when we built healthcare. So I think we came to accept that there needed to be someone else running this and not us. The example, though, I like to use to get to your second point, which was about complexity, is Medicare was enacted in 1965. 1965 was also the introduction of the first mini computer, which was the first computer that just a regular company could use, not just NASA or the Defense Department. That mini computer went for $18,000, which was about 72 times the average cost of healthcare. And in 1965, you would have said computers were the most complex things on earth. It's inconceivable that the average individual could ever use one. So you fast forward 50 years. The average individual has a computer that powerful that they keep in their pocket and that they often decide based on its color. Whereas healthcare has gotten far more complex. And I think you have to ask the question, why did the most complex thing on earth get so simple? And the most personal and arguably directly important thing got more and more complicated. I don't think that's because there's something inherently different. I think it's because we created a system that increased the distance between ourselves and healthcare. At the same time that all other forms of very complicated things, people were getting rich figuring out how to make them simple for us.
I love the fact that your history background and business background combined make you really especially powerful in illustrating the issues. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, David Goldhill, about his book, Catastrophic Care. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with David Goldhill, author of Catastrophic Care and advocate for hospital safety and transparency. And, you know, we talked a little bit about some of the historical elements of what's happened with our healthcare system. And in your book, you talked about us moving further away from what we want in our nation, which is high quality, safe healthcare that's affordable for all. And help us understand why. What is it that needs to change? Why can't we reach this with our current healthcare system? And what do we do?
Well, I think the basic problem, Christy, is that we've built a system that's extraordinarily complicated, and that's always bad for consumers, right? It's very difficult to navigate your way around the system, which means difficult to make sure you're getting adequate care, no matter what the rules are. You know, my argument, and it may sound a bit simplistic, but I think it's fundamental, is that healthcare is an industry. No matter who owns it, it's an industry. People are making a living. And unless those people can make more money by delivering higher quality care that is safer at a better value with terrific customer service, then we're going to move in the opposite direction. The incentives are fundamental. And every time you hear a good idea in healthcare, the chances are it reduces the amount of profit somebody can make in the system. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then no matter what rule, no matter what subsidy that the government is doing to try to get to that goal, ultimately, it will fail because it's operating against the interests of the people who have to execute it. There are tons of examples of this. But until you get the fundamental incentives right, I don't think you can hope to get the direction of the system according to what I think are everybody's goals.
Well, let me ask a question there, David, because those who would point out that the cost of the profit in healthcare, the 21% for the health insurance dollar that goes to subsidizing that administrative cost compared to things like Medicare, which has, as you know, a very, very small 3% or less, that's a huge amount of the cost. How do you feel that then works with the future of how we drive down cost and improve quality?
Well, so it's interesting. I mean, you're using the word cost. I use the word prices because these are, in fact, prices. So as you know, private insurance pays higher prices for most services than Medicare does. And private insurance also bears, as you correctly point out, a lot more administrative expense than Medicare does. So why don't we just have Medicare for everybody? Well, the problem is, what we see, I believe, in looking at Medicare is that the low prices that Medicare pays encourages a tremendous amount of excess care. The amount of care seniors have received in the last two generations has essentially doubled, even though they're far healthier than seniors were two generations ago. And when you're looking at an entire economy that is non-transparent, where prices aren't easily discoverable, where there's nobody truly competing on price, you can do a lot of things like that. You know, there are I mean, let me give you the most obvious example that gets at your question. Most people don't know that Medicare payments are processed by private insurers. And so it would seem strange in any other market that when you're processing claims for your own account, the private insurers are, they spend a lot more money doing it when they're processing the claims for someone else's account. My point is that these things are incredibly complicated because the fundamentals of the system are broken. If you want competition on price and on value, you're going to have to have some competitive elements. And neither the private insurance market nor the Medicare market encourage competition among providers, although they fail in very different ways.
Give us an example of the type of incentives for quality that we ought to move towards.
Well, look, what I've argued for is that we and, frankly, other countries have made a mistake in putting somebody between provider and consumer in every single aspect of healthcare. And the Affordable Care Act now extends that basically to everybody for everything. I completely understand why if somebody has a heart attack and they need to be rushed to the hospital, we need a system that doesn't require them to price shop before they get service. But the idea of taking that model and saying, therefore, it should apply to everything, means that you almost never have providers chasing consumers. And in most things in life, whether we like it or not, that incentive that providers have to chase insurance is what drives better service, better quality, and better prices. It is why you have a mini computer that you're carrying around that you can also call and text your friends on. It's not because Congress said, let's make computers smaller and cheaper. What happened is that people have made billions of dollars figuring out ways to make computers smaller, cheaper, and more accessible. As healthcare becomes a bigger part of our lives, becomes more important to driving our satisfaction in life, having nobody incented properly to provide great quality, great service at great prices, it's what's costing us 20% of GDP.
We're talking with David Goldhill, author of the new book, Catastrophic Care. And David, I guess before we get into a couple solutions, some real concrete examples of how you think it should work, are we going to have to choose between this cradle-to-grave safety net or an accountable system of care? Can we have both?
No, I think we can have both. And I think part of it is starting with the understanding that not all healthcare is the same. Increasingly, our political debate talks about healthcare as if everything from, you know, getting hit by a bus to getting your muscles relaxed, they're all the same. In fact, what I argue is because we want genuine security against catastrophe doesn't mean we have to fund and manage every single service the same way. We don't manage the tire business based on the blowout on the highway model. We recognize that there's different services that call for different ways, not just of paying for it, but regulating it and holding it accountable. There are tens of thousands of services that make up healthcare. And yet we treat them from the completely routine to the rare or to the unusual but minor that we all know we're going to have, we're all going to break a bone every now and then, to the truly catastrophic as if they're all the same. And what that does is that strips out of the system the normal discipline we have in all other goods and services that help keep prices down and help keep service and quality up.
So we are coming towards the end of our conversation. I want to be sure we give you a chance to talk about this three-part healthcare plan. There are three points that could improve our healthcare system and benefit us as patients. How would you frame that for our listeners to entice them to read your book?
or your children to get them to listen to you tell them what they need to know about healthcare.
Yeah, because I'm not sure how you entice people to read a book about healthcare policy. I'm not even sure why I do it.
This is a fun read. We get a lot of books. We don't have everyone on the show. This is a fun read.
Well, thank you. And for your listeners, most of it really is intended to be in terms we understand from everything else in life. Very little of it is about healthcare as healthcare. But since you gave me the opening, I have to respond. The key to what I'm proposing is to require the whole provider sectors, from doctors to hospitals, to chase consumers in a way we see in other things. And the way I think you get there is you take that enormous amount of money that each and every one of us is pouring into this healthcare system, and you redirect it. You say some part of it, and a relatively small part of it, goes to fund catastrophic health insurance that covers everybody in this country cradle to grave against the true catastrophes that not only can hurt your health, but can make it financially impossible. There's a lot fewer of those than you would think. The second part of it is to free up the rest of the money for people to be direct consumers of most of their health care. to actually not just be the patient, but be the customer. And the third part of it is to regulate the healthcare industry in a proper way, which means that instead of the government being a buyer of services, which it is today, and therefore I would argue a partner in the industry, it becomes a real regulator on transparency, quality, and safety in such a way that lets a consumer economy thrive. I think one of the problems, particularly in this country, and a very politicized nation we have, is that unfortunately a lot of decisions about healthcare, when it is the government buying healthcare, get affected by politics, campaign contributions. I mean, just for an example, in the fiscal cliff bill, which was saving the country from default, senators managed to put in two different provisions to change the prices of drugs and procedures offered during Medicare. That happens all the time. Not a great way to do healthcare. And so one of the issues we have is the more and more the government is a principal in the healthcare business, the more this type of distortion works its way into the system. I'd rather see it be held accountable as a regulator, because a remarkable amount of the industry isn't regulated at all.
Well, you know, I think we appreciate your willingness to dive in here and to put something out there. Once you write it down on paper, people can attack it. But on the other hand, you're part of the conversation, and you've suggested that it may take a number of generations to move to the next phase. And I think many of us who are so in the trenches aren't aware of the phases we've been to. We appreciate you taking the time. David Goldhill, the author of Catastrophic Care, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, passion, and vision with your health listeners.
Adam, Christie, thanks so much for having me on today.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christie Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christie Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you want us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some interesting house calls today about some really difficult problems like unrelenting pain in the low back.
About trying to find a new therapist in a new town.
About if you have chronic pain and anxiety and you stop your medicines, is that serious?
Yes.
And about challenges around grief of a loved one, a loss of a loved one.
Let's listen to our very first house call.
My father has excruciating pain in his back. He was told he has acroiditis, perhaps from a failed spine surgery or injections in the past. Is there any hope for him?
Arachnoiditis. Boy, that is a tough word to say, harder word to spell, and boy, is it a difficult condition to have. We're so sorry to hear that.
And what this is inflammation and scarring of the bottom part of your spinal cord, which sometimes happens from a previous surgery or, as you mentioned, from injections in the past, and can be, as you're saying, Adam, really, really painful.
And, you know, unfortunately, there is, a good news, kind of bad news situation here, which the bad news is that we know how painful this is. You know how painful this is. And you do want to avoid more injections, and particularly more surgery, because it's likely to make it worse and go from bad to worse. And the good news is, though, that you can take certain pain medications that may make life livable and tolerable again.
Some people go through a process of getting on opioid medications or narcotic pain medications, and there are also certain pain pumps that can be helpful for patients. So you're going to want to work very closely with your doctor to find the right thing for
and
relief.
And probably even be with a pain specialist, because this is a very difficult condition, requires a lot of expertise here. So thank you for sharing that. We do believe there's hope. And for all of our listeners who maybe have similar kinds of conditions, let's listen to our very next house call.
I am new to town and I need a therapist. My family doctor said he could not really help. because she does not know what providers are on my insurance plan and who is taking new medications. What am I supposed to do?
This is a common challenge for people in a new town as well as for someone just seeking a new therapist in general, and one that I am challenged as a provider to guide people in the most straightforward way in our current system.
Yeah, and I can understand your family doctor saying they couldn't really help, even though that not sure I would agree with that particular
sure.
position, because I think there's always ways of help. It is true that a lot of health insurance plans do require you, even when you're depressed or anxious, to be the one to call and to kind of activate your health benefits. That doesn't mean your family doctor, though, can't give you your opinion of three or four really good specialists who may be on your health insurance plan.
And by calling your insurance plan, if you really are starting from scratch, you could call and get a list that they do cover, and then use word of mouth and go back to your doctor and talk more about do you know any of these specific people and their approach. And to some degree, you also have to probably make an appointment with a couple different people and determine what's the right fit for you.
It's kind of like going to see a new family doctor. You ask your friends, you know, and ask their friends' friends. You look online and see how they're rated. You go meet them and see if you like them. And hopefully you find one that's taking new patients as well. And this is the same way. We know it's hard in the mental health field because there are a lot of restrictions. Do work with your family doctor or your best friend. Both of them can be helpful in this particular circumstance.
Let's take our very next house call question.
I went to see my family doctor several weeks ago, and while I have chronic pain and anxiety, I was feeling much, much worse, like the world was coming to an end. He diagnosed me as going through withdrawal. My medicines had run out 10 days before. After restarting them, my symptoms completely resolved. I just wanted to share something that I did not know and how bad this really made me feel.
What a story. And I wonder, I think a lot of people learn this the hard way, that if you are on a significant amount of these pain medicines, like Percocet or hydrocodone or other things, and you stop them, you can feel horrible if you don't back off on them slowly.
Yeah, and these anti-anxiety medicines like Valium or Ativan or Klonopin. And the reality is, if you've been on them a long time, more than 1 to 3 months, you might have to take months, if not up to a year, to slowly taper off of them to avoid this withdrawal, which you've described pretty accurately.
If you're on those anxiety benzo medicines that you mentioned, Adam, if you come off of those abruptly, just stop them, you can become confused. You could even die from stopping large doses abruptly.
Seizures. We've seen
if you're
that.
On pain medicines and you come off of them abruptly, you might want to die, but it probably won't actually kill you.
You're going to feel like the world is coming to an end, even though it won't. But the bottom line here, do not stop these medications suddenly. There are good reasons to get off of them, and we encourage people to be on little as they can, but work with your doctor on this. Thank you for sharing that house call. Let's listen to our very last house call.
My father died last month after suffering from Alzheimer's for several years. I know I should feel bad, and I was close with him, but in reality, I feel relieved as I had to care for him daily. When I think about this, though, I also feel guilty for not feeling bad. Is this normal?
Our heart certainly goes out to you for the loss of your father and processing these feelings. Is it normal? It certainly is common that there is some provider relief from knowing that that part of your life and of his life that may have been difficult has come to an end. And some people do feel guilty about it.
I think that you are dealt with so much over so long a period of time that when you have a loved one and a spouse and a parent that had Alzheimer's, that you've already gone through probably the full gamut of emotions, and guilt's the last thing you need right now. So if you don't feel guilty, that's okay. You'll probably have some conflicting emotions at some point in time in the future, and you'll have to deal with those emotions then. But right now, I think it's okay. Whatever you're feeling, it's okay.
And there are certain counselors to talk with that specialize in grief and helping you process some of these feelings. And I would encourage you to talk openly with someone about that to be sure that you're getting the support that you need.
Yeah, you know, Christy, I had a friend recently who lost a parent. And for the first 3 months, she kind of felt like this. She didn't really feel like she needed to do anything. And then all of a sudden, one day, she told me that she's going to a grief support group 3 months later. So the right time, the right place, the right therapy. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of you for all of your questions. And if you have questions you want to send to us for an upcoming show, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or search for our new iTunes app.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, David Goldhill. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.